we are about to start a new journey. I just kind of started it last week, barely. But we're beginning beyond this week a new journey into what we call the New Testament. The New Testament, which, by the way, was originally called the New Covenant, but then later in the Latin and with the Roman Church's influence became known as the New Testament. But we also can refer to them as the Christian Scriptures. Whenever you see the word Scriptures, don't get freaked out by that. Scriptures simply means writings. So it's the Christian writings. Just like the Old Testament or the Old Covenant writings were the Hebrew Scriptures or the Hebrew writings, told the story of Israel. The Christian Scriptures tell us the story of Jesus and the early church. And we're about to begin this journey through the Christian writings, the New Testament collection together. Now, today I got bad news and good news for you. Maybe. The bad news might be that if you like the stories that we tell Sunday to Sunday, there are no stories today. Today is going to be Nerd Day again. It's like the eighth day of the week. It's a Friday, Saturday, Sunday Nerd Day. This is Sunday. It's both. So this is Nerd Day. But I have no candy to pass out to you today to help you through it, because we're going to do today for the New Testament what we did for the Old Testament when we started that, which is to give you an overview of what's coming for the foreseeable future. So today is kind of an introduction to the New Testament, an overview. No stories today, I'm sorry. But the good news is, starting next week, we're going to get into the stories of the New Testament, beginning next Sunday and beyond. But I need to set the stage today. So hopefully, now at the end of my message, I will give you something hopefully practical to take home. But in the meantime, just get ready to be into school or something right now, I guess. I don't know. Hopefully it's more interesting than otherwise. The New Testament, or the Christian Scriptures, contains 27 books. 27 books. Now, there were more written by the early church disciples and others who were there, but 27 have been kept into our canon of the New Testament collection. And these 27 books can fit into six categories. And I'm going to give all of them to you right now. Before I do, if when I do this it sounds like too much to you, if what I'm about to do sounds like, you know, like my head is spinning, don't worry, because we're just getting started. Now, for some of you, this is old news. Maybe you're refreshing yourself on the structure of the New Testament. But if this is new to you, don't freak out if you can't grasp the macro in one take, because we're going to go through all of it for the foreseeable future. And by the time we do that, you're going to be an expert. You'll be an expert in the New Testament at some point down the road. But right now we're doing the 30,000-foot view flyover. Next week we land the plane and begin to walk through it more slowly. Okay? There's an analogy for you. So here's the 27 books that are in the New Testament divided into six categories. The first category is the Gospels. The Gospels include four books: Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Now, just in case that's confusing to you, just in case the term, you're like, Gospels? Doesn't gospel mean good news? Yes, gospel means good news. We often say the gospel is that Jesus died for our sins and was buried and rose again so that we could be forgiven and have eternal life. That's what we say the gospel is, and that's the right explanation. But these four books are called the Gospels because they tell the story of the life of Jesus, so we call them that. So we're going to come back to that later in the service, okay? So let me put that on pause for a moment. The second category of books in the New Testament collection is the books of history, which is one book. It's the book of Acts, or Acts of the Apostles. And basically, this tells the story of the church after Jesus finished his ministry and left, the early church, how it explodes onto the scene, how it spreads throughout that area and then throughout the world. And then the back part of the book of Acts tells the story of the apostle Paul and his adventures. By the way, he helps spread the church message globally. Paul, by the way, is one of the most famous characters in the Bible, both Old and New Testament. You have Jesus at the center of it all. You have some Old Testament characters like Abraham and Moses and David. But Paul, in the New Testament particularly, after Jesus, it's Paul, Peter, James, and John are there too. Paul's a big name. And we're going to see his story and the story of the early church blossoming from nothing into a global phenomenon starting in the book of Acts. And that comes after the life of Jesus. The third category in the New Testament collection is Paul's letters to the churches. Now, Paul, besides traveling and spreading the good news of Jesus everywhere, and churches sprouted up wherever he went, he would write letters back to those churches. And some of the churches he wrote to, by the way, not all, there's more. He wrote more letters than this. They're out there, but only these ones are contained in what we call the New Testament collection. So the ones that we have today in this collection are Romans, 1 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians, Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, 1 Thessalonians, and 2 Thessalonians. Then the fourth category is Paul's letters to individuals. He wrote some individual letters to people he mentored or helped. That's 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, Titus, and Philemon. The fifth category is called general letters. Basically, these are letters written by someone other than Paul, because Paul wrote a lot. And this is James, the brother of Jesus, Peter, the disciple, John, the disciple, Jude, the brother of Jesus. They all have contributed. So the general letters are Hebrews, James, 1 Peter, 2 Peter, 1 John, 2 John, 3 John, and Jude. The last and sixth category is called the Book of Revelation. And someone would argue that the Book of Revelation belongs in category 5 as one of the general letters. That's a good argument. We're keeping it separate because it's not just a general letter like in some parts of it. It's also a very apocalyptic book, and it's kind of very unique in that way. So we'll cover that someday if we live long enough. Okay, so anyhow, those are the 27 books. Again, if that's like old news for you, maybe that's a refresher for you. And if you didn't catch all that good news, the table of contents in your Bible can tell you the same thing I took too long to tell you. But when we land the plane and begin our journey through the New Testament, it'll all sink in and you'll learn a lot in the months ahead. I want to come back to the beginning point there. The first section was called the Gospels. The stories of the life of Jesus called Matthew, or some would say the Gospel according to Matthew, the Gospel according to Mark, the Gospel according to Luke, and the Gospel according to John. Four accounts of the life of Jesus, the Christ. They tell the same story, but with different perspectives, from each other. And the reason that's important is because if you read that and don't understand it, you might get confused about why do you need four accounts and why do they not all say the exact same thing in the exact same way, in the exact same order? And it's because there are four perspectives of the same life, but they are different perspectives. It'd be kind of like if you and I were to travel to any house, a mansion or a there's a place in Cedar Lake here, actually. It looks like a castle. Have you guys seen that house back there on 113th Avenue? It looks like a castle. So, I mean, it's interesting. If you were to drive to that house today and four of us went there and stood on all sides of the property and looked at that structure, we would see something different from different spots in which we stood. If the four of us came back and told the room full of people what we saw at that property, we would all be describing the exact same house slash castle, except for we would probably have a few different details, wouldn't we? Based upon it, maybe someone stood in a spot where they saw something about the house that nobody else saw from their vantage point. Or somebody else saw the same thing that another person saw from a different angle. So you'd have different perspectives that are not contradictions. They were just telling the same story through a different lens. Now, I say that for this reason. The Gospels tell the same story of the same life witnessed by multiple people, but they each have their own perspective from where they stood. And these differences are interesting. The first three of those books, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, are the most similar to each other. In fact, nerdy detail here, the first three are called the Synoptic Gospels by many people. Matthew, Mark, and Luke, the Synoptic Gospels, because they tell the most similar, still different from each other in detail, but the most similar version of the story of the life of Jesus. While John is the most unique of the four. In fact, John spends over half of his writing telling us about the last month of the life of Jesus, and the first less than half of his writing telling the rest of Jesus' story. Whereas Matthew, Mark, and Luke spend much more time on the early part of Jesus' story, and some time, but not as much time, on the last month and week. So they just have different feels, but it's all the same story, different perspectives. And I say that because once in a while, you might come up with a skeptic who will say that these things are contradictions. And they're not. They're not. They are simply, actually what they are is they're a good defense against the accusation of collusion. You know what collusion is, right? An example of collusion would be if something, crime happened and you were witnesses or suspects or whatever, and a detective pulled you in the room with four other people and asked you to tell what happened exactly, and everyone in the room told the exact same story using the exact same words and the exact same everything, he'd be like, that sounds like collusion to me. Sounds like you worked that story out amongst yourselves. It doesn't sound trustworthy. When you see old historical records and they're too identical, you're like, okay, someone just copied some stuff. But when you get historical periods with different perspectives, it helps you understand, okay, there's just more nuance and details, and those things just help fill out and give credence to what was recorded. And so the Gospels have different perspectives. Each view enriches our understanding. Now, I want to point this out. The way they're different, some of them will tell stories that the others won't tell. Sometimes a story is only in one of the four accounts. Sometimes it's in two of them. Sometimes it's in three. Some of them are in all four accounts. Sometimes their chronology of how the story is laid out is differently because chronology was not the point of the writing. But we can read that and say, well, wait a minute, I thought this happened before that. It doesn't matter. Sometimes it does matter. Sometimes it doesn't matter. You can usually tell the difference with very little effort. But some of it's harder. For example, how he calls his disciples at the beginning of his adult ministry is very PC, and you got to kind of work, you got to put all the pieces on the table and step back and look at them to make it all fit. And so we're going to see all that stuff because the stories are different, the details are different sometimes in the stories and so forth. Again, because it's not a collusion of story, it's a unique perspective of the life of Jesus from multiple viewpoints. I'm in just a moment here, I'm going to walk you through the first couple, maybe the first verse or three of each of these four gospel accounts, just so we can see how they begin. Before I do, let me just talk about the authors and their personalities for a little bit, okay? The authors are fourfold. Matthew is one. Matthew was one of the 12 disciples of Jesus Christ. He was up close and personal. He was a former tax collector who became a believer and a follower of Jesus. And Matthew is an interesting guy. In fact, if you've ever watched the TV series The Chosen, you'll see Matthew is portrayed on there as almost someone who's on the spectrum a little bit, right? Which is an interesting take on Matthew because he's really good with numbers and details, but not so good socially. It's an interesting version of Matthew because you're trying to find a sympathetic character. Most people hated the countrymen among them who were traitors enough to collect taxes for the Roman oppressors. And Matthew did that before coming to Jesus. So the Chosen gives him an interesting viewpoint. I'd love to think that's true. Who knows? But Matthew, his version is genealogical records and proving that the Old Testament and New Testament version of Jesus is the same. He's the king of the Jews. He tells the story of Joseph, the stepfather of Jesus, before Jesus is born. He tells the story of not baby Jesus. He tells the story of toddler Jesus, like little 1 or 2-year-old Jesus running around, okay? And so this is one story, not much about Jesus as much as what was happening around him. That's Matthew. That's his version. I'm going to jump ahead to John. John is also one of the 12 disciples of Jesus. He was probably the youngest of the 12 disciples. He was a fisherman with his brother, older brother James, and Peter and Andrew, all four who became disciples of Jesus. John was most likely the youngest, and he definitely outlived the rest of them. And he writes this and other things later in his story. Now, John, his story... we'll get to John in a minute here. Let me go to Mark. Mark is a name that you won't see until you read the book of Acts, the history of the church. Mark pops in there a couple times along the way. He's even mentioned in the epistles later on. But Mark, most people believe that when Mark writes this account of the life of Jesus, he's actually writing down what Peter remembers. He's writing Peter's story down. Peter was one of the 12 disciples. He was kind of the leader. He was kind of a hard-charging, shoot first, think later sometimes, good leader most of the time guy. Peter probably wasn't going to sit down and write anything, okay? But he told his story to those around him. He was very close at one point with Mark, and Mark writes down the account of Jesus's life largely from Peter, we believe, is his recorded version. Which means if that's the case, which we believe it is, that Matthew and Mark and John are all three records of the life of Jesus recorded by three of his 12 disciples, although one was through another pen. Which leaves us with Luke. And Luke is the most unique of all of them. Luke was not a disciple of Jesus. In fact, Luke, guess what does anyone know what Luke did for a career at first? He was a doctor, right? He's a physician, right? Good job. He was a physician or a doctor who became a believer and a follower of Jesus after Jesus was finished with his ministry. Luke actually tagged teams with Paul the Apostle on his missionary work. You'll actually see Luke enter the story in the first-person narrative in the back part of the book of Acts. Well, Luke stops being a physician, it seems. Maybe he still practices, I don't know. But he becomes a historian. He goes back, he writes the story of Paul, which he witnesses firsthand, and then he goes back and researches the life of Jesus and cross-references sources and separates fact from fiction and does a lot of hard work to give us an accurate account of the life of Jesus. He then writes another historical book, also deep research and cross-referencing his sources and so forth, to write the history of the early church in Acts. Acts and Luke are both written by Luke. Former doctor turned historian and believer in Jesus. So anyhow, they're all four different. For example, Luke and Matthew both tell early stories of young Jesus' life. Luke tells us the Christmas story of the birth of Jesus and stories before Jesus was born about Mary, his mother, and other people. Matthew tells early stories of Jesus. Mark does not, and John does something different. Well, let's look at those together. Ready? We'll read a couple verses from each of these four accounts. Told you it's nerdy today, but hopefully it's helpful. The first one is Matthew. Matthew 1:1 begins this way. This is a record of the ancestors of Jesus the Messiah, a descendant of David and Abraham. I will not expound on that anymore because if you were with us last Sunday, we had a whole message from the first six verses of Matthew about this section here. But just notice that Matthew, this numbers and details guy, writes down this chronology, this genealogy of Jesus' life and stories of young Jesus before he was born and while he was little. And then he gets into the adult ministry of Jesus. Mark is different. Okay, when I get to Mark, I'm going to tell you right now, Mark does not mess with the birth of Jesus or genealogies. Again, especially makes sense if Peter is the one who's sending the message through him. Peter doesn't care about all that kind of stuff. So when Mark writes his account down, he just jumps past genealogies. He jumps past baby Jesus. He wants to start with adult Jesus doing adult stuff. And so Mark begins with the adult ministry of Jesus at the age of 30. Mark chapter 1, verse 1 says, this is the good news about Jesus the Messiah, the Son of God. It began, and then he begins. He's off to the races. In fact, Mark chapter 1, verse 1 kind of starts where Matthew and Luke get to in chapter 4. Because he just skips all those early stuff and gets to the 30-year-old Jesus. All right? Now, Luke is like Matthew. He goes back to the early days. And notice, remember, Luke is the historian. He was not one of the 12 disciples, but he was careful. Watch what he says in Luke chapter 1, verse 1. He says, many people have set out to write accounts about the events that have been fulfilled among us. They used the eyewitness reports circulating among us from the early disciples. Having carefully investigated everything from the beginning, I also have decided to write an accurate account for you, most honorable Theophilus. Theophilus is the person that Luke is dedicating in his foreword of his book here. Theophilus is the one he dedicates his writing to. It's interesting because Luke also writes the book of Acts, and at the beginning of the book of Acts, he also dedicates that history book to Theophilus as well. Whoever Theophilus was, he got these books dedicated to him at the beginning. Here's what I've done for you. I have cross-referenced, I have done research, I have made sure that I have triple-checked my sources, I have talked to lots of people to give you a carefully investigated and accurate account so that you don't have to wonder what's true and what's not. This is a You know what Luke was doing? Luke was being the Ken Burns of his day, if I can say that for you history buffs, right? Or I was going to name another author in the first service, and I couldn't remember their first name. But anyhow, a great historian. And he says, let me give you the details of something that just happened. I've talked to the people who were there extensively. Here's an accurate account for you. Why? Verse 4. So you can be certain of the truth of everything that you were taught. I want you to have confidence that what I'm giving you is trustworthy. So again, three accounts so far. Mark jumps into the adult story of Jesus. Matthew and Luke start with genealogies early on, and they tell the story of the pre-birth of Jesus, the birth of Jesus, or the young life of Jesus for a little bit. That was their beginning point. But then we come to John. John is the fourth gospel account, and John does something completely different than everybody else. John is going to take us to the beginning, but a very different beginning than the rest. John's going to call their attention back to the beginning of everything. So he goes back to the beginning of the Hebrew scriptures or the Old Testament. The first book of the Old Testament, somebody tell me the first book of the Old Testament is? Genesis. And Genesis chapter 1, verse 1 begins with, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. And of course, the story of creation is laid out, whether you want to absorb that as very, very literal or poetic to explain the stuff that we understand as we understand the science of the world more. It does not matter how we sort that. The bottom line is Genesis begins by saying, in the beginning, God did it all. And so John, when he writes his account of the life of Jesus 2,000 years ago from now, does not start with the genealogy record, doesn't start with baby Jesus born in the manger story of, you know, he starts with a different beginning. So watch how John begins his gospel account in John chapter 1, verse 1. In the beginning, the Word already existed. So that when he says that, everyone of his audience then, and even now who study the Bible, would know that when they read those words, their minds are pulled back to Genesis 1:1. And John begins with a reference. In the beginning, the Word already existed. And he says, the Word. So by the way, the Word there, the Word is a reference to Jesus, just so you know. You're going to see that throughout this next dozen verses that John refers to Jesus as the Word, that he was already around. So his beginning didn't start with Mary or Joseph. He was around way before then. And then he says, the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And when John mentions that, he is making a reference to the triune God, or the Trinity as we call it, which is a very complicated subject matter. To try to explain the Trinity, how could God be three persons in one? I don't know, it's kind of weird. Hard to understand. People have divided over trying to understand the Trinity so much that denominations have split from each other over the Trinity. People have been called heretics by other people over how they try to explain the Trinity. Isn't that sensible? Like, how you explain the impossibly to understand God is a heresy. So, and people get mad. Because it's a big, complicated deal. And John's like, the Word was with God and the Word was God. Well, was he with God or was he God? Which is it? Yes, I don't know. I mean, yes, it's a mystery. It's big, but I'm just telling you, he was there. John chapter 1, verse 2 says this, he existed in the beginning with God. Verse 3, God created everything through him, and nothing was created except through him. Now, that's a big idea. Those of you who want to nerd out about creation and all that picture, here's a little thing to chew on. Him is Jesus. God created everything through him, and nothing was created except through him. Yeah, we hear a story as born of a baby to dwell among us a couple thousand years back, but John says that's not his origin. He was in the beginning, and everything was created through him, through Jesus. And nothing was created except through him. Isn't that an interesting thought for some of us to think about when we think about where this all began? It says in verse 4, the Word gave life to everything that was created, and his life brought light to everyone. Not only did he bring life into the world, he brought light into the world. We're celebrating the season of light. Look at verse number 5. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness can never extinguish it. I love that. I love that. In other words, for 2,000 years, for 2,000 years now, people have tried over and over again to extinguish the light of the message of Jesus Christ. And they never succeed because the darkness can never extinguish it. And that's why 2,000 years later, on the other side of the planet, we're gathering in his name today, celebrating, because the darkness has never been able to extinguish the light that Jesus brought. Here we are. That's some good news right there. We're going to skip down to verse 10. I love this little section here. It's kind of sad, but it's interesting. Verse 10 says, he, referring to Jesus, he came into the very world he created, but the world did not recognize him. The idea here is that though he was the creator, as we saw earlier, the creator of all things, when he came into the world had taken the gift of life and the gift of freedom of choice or free will. We've taken those freedoms and we have abused them so bad and gone so far from God's original intent that when he shows up, when God in a bod shows up, the world didn't even recognize him. It says he came into the very world he created, but the world did not recognize him. Worse than that, verse 11, he came to his own people, and even they rejected him, referring to the Jewish people who had prophets for hundreds of years prophesying that God was sending a Messiah, a Savior for the world coming their way. And they misunderstood what that meant, and they didn't even see him when he came. And they rejected him. And that's a whole story that we're going to see unpack in the months ahead. But I love verse 12. But to all who believed him and accepted him, he gave the right to become children of God. That word right, the right to become. Right could also be interpreted as authority, or some translations would say power to become. He gave the right to become children of God. Now, children of God is an interesting idea, because the implication would be that all of us understand ourselves to be the creation of our maker, that we are created beings and God is our maker. But that we are also a very rogue creation, right? We've made our own decisions. We've gone our own direction. We're a rogue creation. However, what's interesting is that God sent Jesus into the world to show us the heart of God to bring us back into relationship with him. And as we understand that, as we believe that and accept that, as we believe him and accept him, it moves our understanding from just being a part of God's creation as he's our maker to saying we are God's children and he's our father. So it's a shift. It's a shift of relational dynamic that is mentioned here through our faith in Christ. Now, look at verse number 13. They are reborn, not with a physical, by the way, that word reborn is where we get the term born again. It's referenced a few times. They are being born, if you heard that term in culture, being born again, kind of comes from here. It says people who believe in him, they are reborn, not with a physical birth resulting from human passion or plan. You know what that means, right? Births come from human passion or plan. Like every one of you on your birthday, you celebrate that 9 months before you were born, there was some human passion. Okay, you get the idea. Or plan, usually. Planning, sometimes not planning, but anyhow. But this is not a physical birth. This is a spiritual birth, a born again, a birth that comes from God. And while he's talking about our being born again through faith, in doing so, he's kind of shedding a little bit of a light on a bigger idea that he doesn't talk about so much as Matthew and Luke do, which is that Jesus himself didn't come in a traditional, his birth into this world was not his origin point. It was a physical birth from his already existence, that he was born not from human passion or plan, but a birth that came from God. And that we experience a spiritual birth through that faith in him the same way. Anyhow, one more verse to show you, and we'll spend a few minutes here and we'll be done today. I love this verse so much. John 1:14. So the Word became human and made his home among us. That first sentence right there, that first sentence is Christmas summarized. If you want Christmas in one sentence, there it is. The Word became human and made his home among us. There's Christmas. That's what we celebrate this time of year. I love that. Beautiful. But then he says this, he was full of grace and truth, and we have seen his glory, the glory of the Father's one and only Son. And maybe someone would say, wait a minute, didn't you just say that we all become children of God or sons and daughters of God through faith? How is he the one and only? And the implication is that we are God's creation, a rogue creation, who when we understand God's love for us and we believe that and accept that, when we through faith are, it's almost like an adoption into an understanding of being God's children. Jesus was something completely different. He was from the beginning. The older translations say the only begotten Son. Same idea, the one and only Son. He's a whole different ballgame. And so that's what the author is referencing here in this verse. Now, that's all the ground we're going to cover. I'm not done yet, but that's all the ground we're going to cover today. I told you there's no stories today. I'm so sorry if you like the stories of the Bible. Good news, we're back to the stories next week and beyond. But I felt it was important to give us an overview of the story. And that was what today was about. So hopefully you understand the New Testament, 27 writings collected in this one big collection, the Christian writings. The first category is the Gospels, the story of Jesus' life, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John. They're different, but they're the same story, just different perspectives. They all tell a different angle. Matthew and Luke from the birth time of Jesus, Mark from the adult time of Jesus, John from the very beginning, and then he jumps into the birth to the adult ministry of Jesus. But they're all giving us the same account. And that's the overview. That's going to get us started in the stories we begin next week. Before I go, I want to give you something practical, because that was a lot of information. So something practical to take home with you today is found in the verse, in the words that are highlighted on the screen here. That he, referring to Jesus, he was full of grace and truth. I love that statement so much. Because let's be really honest today. Grace and truth sometimes feel like contradictory ideas to most people. Most people are pretty good at either grace or truth. Very few figure out how to do both very well. There are the people who are like, I'm about, this is the truth. I understand it. You need to see it my way. I have the truth. And they seem to have a lack of grace in their dogmatism, while others sometimes hate that mentality for understandable reasons, and so they become all about grace, but they're afraid to tiptoe into sounding dogmatic, so they avoid truth. And they can move into moral relativism, which is also unhelpful. And so, how do you get humanity that struggles with either grace or truth to understand that that both are important? Well, Jesus was full of grace and truth. This is so powerful. Jesus was not some kind of balance, you know, trying to keep the balance of grace and truth. He wasn't like 50% grace, 50% truth, makes up a whole person. No, he was full of grace and truth. He was 100% truth and 100% grace at the same time. And that's hard to comprehend because, again, most of us can't seem to get that figured out. And if I could be honest, if Jesus is showing us the way, the path to which we should take, and by the way, we should, we're called to believe on Jesus, but also to follow Jesus. As he gives us the path or the way to go, which is grace and truth fully, most people end up in one ditch or the other. Not because they're necessarily 100% and 0% one or the other, but because we tend to be weighted one way more than the other, and we end up off the road. Again, some people fall themselves into just, I don't know, there's nothing truth. What is truth, you know? And others fall into a spot where they're so dogmatic about the truth that they understand that they seem to forget the importance of grace. And so that lack of what Jesus did makes us very toxic people in the culture we're trying to reach. And if I could be blunt, my experience of 26 years of pastoring is that the modern evangelical Christian church of today, of the West, is probably tilted a little too much on the side of truth with too little grace. And I know that some of us would say, I don't think that's true. I think it's the other way. But maybe that's because of where we're tilted. If we're tilted that way, of course we're going to think that that's the most important emphasis and we're going to be bothered. But I watch all the people who are far from God, and what they hear, the message they're hearing from us, is one of very certainty but truth and not much grace that they feel being portrayed. We haven't given grace to each other. And I don't mean we should have no truth. I mean we should seek the truth. But where's the grace? Because here's the problem. Here's the problem with truth for us. Our truth is limited. If the truth was so easy, just hang with me now. If the truth was so easy, why is there more than one denomination in Christianity? I'm just asking a question here. Forget all the religions of the world. It'd be so easy if it was so, the church was so clear that we all got the Bible, there's one denomination. And yet a lot of very sincere people have verses and reasons why they see things differently. Of course, we all highlight verses that we think are more important and ignore the ones that are a little harder to explain, right? Everyone plays that game. So why are there so many denominations? Why are there factions within the denominations? Just asking. And here's the thing. It's like the Trinity. Remember the Trinity earlier? I have watched. There's a whole skit we've played before. If I should do it again, it's funny to me. Of people yelling and calling each other heretics over how they explain the complexity of the Trinity. They all give these really cool explanations. And that's a heresy, you know, because that's how people get. Like, I got the truth and you're a heretic if you don't see it my way. That's the kind of truth we embrace. Why are there so many different views? Because let's be honest, none of us have a corner on the truth. I want to wager a thought to some of the more dogmatic among us here. All of us will get to heaven someday and realize we did not have a corner on the truth. We're probably going to get there and say, oh, I had some things right and I had some things a little bit wrong. Whoops. But so in the meantime, why do we run around and have struggles fighting for our truth with grace? And I think that's the danger zone we tilt into. And I'll tell you why I think we tilt that way. Because I've seen a lot of churches who sing about grace, but when we preach about it, and I'm not bashing churches, that includes us, okay? I hate when I say that. I'm gonna back my words up real quick here. Most Christians are lovely people. Most churches are wonderful places. This is not an indictment against everybody who's got it wrong. This is just saying human nature tends to pull us in one direction or the other. And I've heard a lot through the years of people who can't seem to talk much about grace. I came from a movement that never preached about grace. And if they ever did once every 20,000 messages, 75% of that sermon was what grace isn't. So they cannot get you confused because they don't want to give too much grace. And so when I see the lack of grace we have towards people who don't live the way we think they should live, vote the way we think they should vote, denomination the way they think they should denomination, worship the way they think they should worship, raise their family the way they think they should raise their family, because we're right and therefore everyone else is wrong, then we're about truth without grace. And yet a lot of sincere people have landed on different spots. I'm not saying relativism is the answer. I'm saying that while we seek the truth, where's the grace? And here's why. Here, let me get to the bottom line here. The difference between you and me is we can wrestle about what is the truth and what is not and disagree. Here's a thought for you. Don't lose me now, okay? Here's the thought for you. Unlike us, Jesus was the truth. Like, he was full of truth. He was 100% truth. Like, he wasn't just 100%. He was Jesus' own words. Jesus' own words were, I am the way, the truth, and the life, right? He was the truth. So if Jesus, who has a right to be dogmatic, if Jesus, who has a right to say, you disagree with me? I'm right, you're wrong, obviously. Jesus, who was the truth, could be also full of grace. Then how much more should you and me, who aren't the truth, how much more should you and me be full of grace? How much more should you and me have some humility to our opinions and our beliefs? Because if Jesus, who was actually always right, was full of grace and truth, how much more should we, who are trying to seek the truth, have a lot of humility about our views and a lot of grace along the way? Thank you. Now, Here's the answer. And I know we're not Jesus. We are probably more in the balancing act of it all. Like, almost all of us, we're like driving the car on the road and the car drifts to the left, so you course correct. But you can't keep course correcting, you'll be in the ditch on the right. So we're probably going to course correct as humans because we're not Jesus, right? But we're striving to be like him. We're striving to believe on him and follow him. So I have a statement to give you today that I love. It's a simple statement. It goes like this. Jesus is the best of both worlds. I love that statement. I'm going to tell you, that's an Anthony Curtis statement. He hates me giving him credit for it, but that's an Anthony Curtis statement. Like when we were sitting down planning the sermon, and I'm like rambling like I'm doing right now to all of you, and he's like, okay, here's Arlen's vision for the sermon. He heard that, and he sat down, and he wrote those words and showed them to me. I'm like, Anthony, that's phenomenal. Jesus is the best of both worlds. In other words, he's the best of this world that he came, was born as a baby, and was born among us and brought us salvation. He's the best of this world, but he's the best of the world from which he came and to which he returned, where he's sitting on the right hand of the Father, and every knee's going to bow, and every tongue will confess that he is Lord someday. He's the best of both worlds. But also, he's the best of both worlds in regards to things like grace and truth. Well, is he more about grace or more about truth? Because I know which one I am. He's the best of both worlds. He's the best of truth. He's the best of grace. He's got it all figured out. And our goal is to be as much like him as possible. So, what I'm saying is this. While you and I seek the truth, are you with me? While we seek, and we should seek the truth, and follow the truth as we understand it to the most sincere of our abilities as individuals. Let's do that. We need to do that. The truth is important. Let's also have enough humility to understand that sometimes good people have, not in every way, some things are very clear, other things are fuzzy. It might have different perspectives about certain things along the way than we do, certain expressions of our faith, certain expressions of our views than we do. And have enough humility to follow the truth we believe we have, but full of grace for other people who are trying to figure it out. Walk in the truth as we, and by the way, as we walk in the truth, part of the truth is being willing to say, I've had it wrong so far. I'm not loyal to my sentimentality. If I've been thought it was this way and I realize something's different, I'm not gonna close my mind and shudder out of fear of change. I'm going to open my mind to the truth if I don't have it, because I'd rather be right than sentimental. So I'm gonna seek the truth always, with an open heart and mind, and live the truth as God shows it to me, while having boatloads of grace for everyone else in their journey as well, whether it's their beliefs or their behaviors or their struggles, because we all are trying to figure it out. Jesus, our example, was the best of both worlds. So I'm done. Here's what I want to say to you as we wrap this thing up. A lot of information today with a little application at the end. The stories begin next week. May we both believe in Jesus as we go through this thing, and may we follow him as well.